Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Robert Johnson and Janie Weston about their book, The Last Kings of Norse America. A fascinating discussion about the pre-Columbus discovery of America. We've known about Vinland for a long time now, of course, but it's still, and Leif Erikson's journeys, but still, for some reason, it's not like it's officially recognized, and there's more and more information and more proof getting out there all the time about this, and this latest book here just adds on to the pile of evidence, and also tells a really fascinating story about the background and the political struggles that was going on at the time in Scandinavia, about the trade and everything else. And the Spirit Pond Runestone, of course, has added tremendous amounts to it, this poem that we just reiterated here at the end of the first hour. I wanted to begin to talk a little bit about the possibility or theorizing a little bit about why it was buried, where it was buried, and if the intention was that this were to be found. Was there possibly an accident that the stone was dropped? I mean, there's so many things we can speculate here about, but what have you guys found when it comes to why it was found where it was found?
Well, that is the only question that I don't have any factual basis to speculate on. Why was the stone left there with the other two small stones? The speculation is that maybe it was used as kind of like a notebook. It wasn't set up as a memorial stone. The memorial poem on it was to be recited when the members of the expedition, in this case King Haakon and his poet friend, when they got back to Norway at a memorial service for the lost men.
Or his skald, as it was called.
Skald, right. Yeah, that's the kind of like a bard or the storyteller.
That's right. He was the official man associated with the expedition, and probably one of those that young King Haakon chose together with his retinue, because he was authorized to do that. He was authorized to pick the 12 men of his retinue and any other men that he chose. So he had a wide latitude, and he probably picked the skull himself. So, let's see, where were we?
Let me ask you this before we carry on. Sorry, Janie, let me just interject. Did they ever return to Norway?
Haakon did get back to Sweden because he did marry in 1363 the daughter of King Valdemar of Denmark, and a very familiar name to all you Swedes, Queen Margaret.
Yep.
Who was the first to...
No, he's Norway.
That's Norway, that's right, but it's still familiar to us, so I know what you're talking about.
But Queen Margaret, as if you're up on your history, she was the first to unite all of Sweden, Norway, and Denmark at the end of the 1300s.
The part of the book which is really sort of important is that after the expedition that was dispatched from Norway by King Magnus had been in North America for a couple of years, Haakon sailed back to Norway, and on that occasion, at that winter of 1359, I think it was, he was betrothed to this young Princess Margaret of Denmark, and he sailed back immediately after his betrothal, as soon as the sailing weather permitted. We know that this was the situation because his brother, Erik the 12th, who had taken over as king of Sweden, his brother died.
Brother, wife, and son.
Yeah, the whole family died, which left Haakon as the legal king of Sweden. In the terms of the forced abdication, Haakon was to succeed his brother if his brother died without having any children. So that was the situation, and but this didn't happen. He wasn't empowered, or he wasn't acclaimed, I should say, as king of Sweden until 1362, but the death of his brother occurred in 1359. Now, they don't wait around for things like that. Life is too short. We know that Håkon was not present in Scandinavia anywhere at that time. As a matter of fact, there is a document, a Norwegian document, to the effect that his mother signed off as consenting that Håkon would become the king of Norway at some future time. That's a historical fact, a documented fact. So we know now that the reason he wasn't in Scandinavia is that he sailed back to North America to participate in this effort to restore the trade empire. And that's an important part of the book, which is not too prominent, but it fits the story very well.
Indeed. Any other thoughts on what could have happened, or if there are other, I guess, evidence or some stories surrounding what actually happened, if the mission was, classified as being successful or something like that?
Well, one interesting thing. I believe it was Ole Worm, a historian of his time, a few hundred years after Håkon, remarked that in the cathedral at Trondheim, in Ole Worm's time, there was a Inuit or Eskimo, depending on which term you want to use, but a kayak, or either a kayak or an umiak. Kayak is for one person, a umiak is for more than one person. A boat, a sealskin covered boat that was suspended up in the ceiling area mm-hmm. of the cathedral in Trondheim. And he had been, Ole Worm was told that that was brought back by, that it was brought back from an expedition all the way beyond Greenland in the 1300s. And let's see, who was given credit? I believe it was Paul Knutsen that was given credit, or either.
No, it was King Håkon himself.
Håkon given
who
credit.
Ran,
okay.
Who was on this wartime expedition or something.
Hmm.
Okay. But it has they since after that was written down by Ole Worm, they were taken down, probably deteriorated to the point where they were falling apart onto people's heads or something, but they were eventually gone and nothing else said of them since then. But that's a pretty good piece of evidence also. One thing that our the woman that wrote our introduction, Marguerite Ragno, a medieval studies professor and curator at the James Ford Bell Library at the University of Minnesota, she remarks in her introduction, which is quite interesting to read too, that at the Greenland archaeological site that translates into farm under the sand in English. It was Gard under Sandet, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably massacring the word, but it was a site revealed by very fast flowing high spring glacial melt water. And for a short period of time, the archaeologists were able to look at this site before the rest of the meltwater swept it away. But in that site, one thing that was found was Native American bison hair. And bison were not something you would find anywhere near Newfoundland. They were on the Great Plains of Central North America.
Wow. Well, that's a big clue.
Yes.
Yeah. Could I kind of recap for the benefit of your listeners who are maybe wondering where this story went?
Yeah, sure. Definitely. Let's go ahead.
It went like this. The expedition that Magnus sent out settled in Rhode Island, and there they built a church over about 3 or 4 years between 1357 and 1361 or 1362. The church is now what we know as the Newport Tower. It's a stone tower that was the central part of the church. The wooden parts extend around the periphery of this stone tower.
As an ambulatory.
Yeah. So that was the focus of the expedition, and it was politically done and it was economically done because in Iceland, for example, in Greenland, there was a powerful priest who was assigned to collect the taxes there, and we think they had somewhat the same idea to do in reestablishing the trade in New England or in North America here. So they built the church, and while the church is being built, they toured or explored the Great Lakes area there and other parts of New England and Quebec and Canada there, explored trying to locate places to trade and people, Norsemen, who were still living there that could be convinced to participate in the trade as was done before the Greenlanders abandoned their homes. So that was the strategy. And after the church was almost built, they had done all they could do there, but they hadn't yet contacted any of the Norsemen who had been living out in western Minnesota and the Dakotas. So the plan, as we relate in our book, was to take ships and do an expedition, sail from Rhode Island around north, past Newfoundland and northern Quebec and into Hudson Bay, and at the southwest corner of Hudson Bay, you find a port and a trading post at the mouth of the Nelson River, which is a major river that drains Lake Winnipeg, and the Lake Winnipeg has a major river called the Red River, which comes from the United States. It's a boundary between the Dakotas and Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So that river system leads down to where the Kensington runestone was found, approximately, and it leads down to the area where Janie and I did a lot of research back in the next 2 or 3 years or so after we did our first examination of the runestone in Alexandria. So the strategy was to sail these three ships around to the mouth of the Nelson River and send a group, not the full expedition, but a group of 30 men in two large, what were freight canoes. They called them afterboats in those days, literally. And those two afterboats with 30 men would go southward on the river system down to the area where the Norsemen were living in eastern South Dakota and western Minnesota, and make the arrangements, do a little trading in the process, make the arrangements for future trade with those guys. That was the plan. So the ship set out in 1361 from Rhode Island. And by the end of that summer, the middle of that summer, actually, they were on Hudson Bay, and they encountered a terrible storm. And the storm was the storm mentioned in the Spirit Pond runestone inscription.
As a shout into the lights. The lights mean lightning.
It was a really terrible storm, and the ship that carried the king's retinue and a crew of five sank, and all the men were lost. Well, that didn't stop the rest of the expedition. The other two ships sailed on, and the 30-man sub-expedition did start southward, and King Haakon had to return because he couldn't spend any more time than the year 1361, because he had to be back by the spring of 1363 for his wedding. That's a historical fact, and it took place in the spring of 1363. So Haakon had to, the expedition split up in the sense that Haakon and Knudsen no longer were together. Knudsen took the 30 men, went south to try to contact the Norsemen, and Haakon took a ship and returned back to New England and spent the winter there at Spirit Pond, at which time he and his skald composed the memorial poem that we found abandoned in this small stone buried in the grass at the mouth of the outlet of Spirit Pond, end of the Marsh River there.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. The king, Haakon, he got back on schedule in late 1362. He was immediately acclaimed as King of Sweden, believe it or not. He didn't last because of politics. But for a while, he was King of Sweden. On the other hand, Knudsen and his 30 men, they looked, but were pretty sure they did not find any Norsemen living in the settlements on the Whetstone River and in other places in western Minnesota, although they looked. We think they spent too much time looking to be able to get back up to where the other ship that they had left had spent the winter. They had intended to go back up to the mouth of the Nelson River and get on that ship and return to New England. But they weren't going to make it, and the ship was going to stay only over one winter. So they had to figure out a different way to return, and we think they decided to try to get over to the Great Lakes by going overland. And that's why they ended up actually down at in the vicinity of Kensington, Minnesota, after they lost 10 men to an Indian massacre on Big Cormorant Lake. That's kind of a short version of the latter part of our story. We don't have any record of Knudsen ever returning to Norway. He may have returned, but there's no way that we can verify that by any sort of a written document. The last thing we have that we can attribute to Knudsen is the Kensington runestone, which Janie and I had a fascinating bit of fun getting a really accurate translation of when we wrote this book.
Yeah, one interesting thing about after we had thoroughly gone through getting the Spirit Pond inscription translated, we thought, you know, we should take a new look at the Kensington runestone inscription with the idea that the double dots over a number of letters are a form of medieval abbreviation, which we now recognize as being such. And with that in mind, and a better understanding of grammar, there were a few things on the Kensington runestone that we found had not been correctly translated. For instance, the one of the last lines of the three lines on the side of the stone, not on the front face, but the side face, refers, well, we realize it said we have a troop of 10 men, house wintered to look after our ship. And no one had translated the word troop before. It had been simply translated as have, but the missing letter that the abbreviation indicates should be there makes it into the word troop, meaning about 10 men. And house wintered also had not been correctly translated. So we know that some guys were, you know, 10 men were left up at the mouth of the Nelson River or Nelson and Hayes Rivers area. They both drain Lake Winnipeg, and they come out at Hudson Bay only a few miles apart from each other. So that is a general area. And no one had figured that out before. There were a few other items that understanding medieval abbreviation, some dots that had been argued over previously as what do they mean. For instance, there's the word on the first line of the Kensington runestone, they refer to 8 Gotter, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's the R has a very distinctive dot in the middle of the leg of the R. And a common, very common medieval manuscript form of abbreviation, if you have a word ending in an R, is to put a slash across the leg of the R. Mm-hmm. And that you're missing a UM or making it a plural. So it's actually not 8 Gotter, it is 8 Gotterum. So it's a Latinized version of Gotlanders.
Yeah. So, Gotlanders. Gutar is the word. Gutar.
What?
Gutar is the word.
Oh, yes, not the G, not the hard G. It would be the U.
Yeah.
Yes, like Göteborg. Okay.
That's right. Gutar, yes. But this was spelled Gutarum, you said.
Yes.
To make it more Latinized. They're Latinizing these words, yeah.
And Latinization of names and groups of people was very commonplace at that time. It's kind of showing off that I'm educated enough, I know a little bit of Latin, and I'm going to throw it in here. So there were a number of things that had been misunderstood or completely missed because of forms of abbreviation, either the double dots over the letters or a dot, for instance, the one on the leg of the R, as well as a few others. So, and some of them are adaptations of what you would have seen in a quill pen inscribed or written manuscript, just mainly because a piece of very hard gray wacky stone, which is the type of stone that the Kensington runestone is inscribed on, it's pretty tough stuff, and trying to put a slash as you would do with a quill pen doesn't work as well, so a dot is a more it's just plain easier.
Works better, yes. Janie, do you have a translation easily accessible there? Can we read through what your translation of the runestone, Kensington runestone, is?
All right. 8 Gotlanders, or Jotlanders. Yeah. Am I saying it better now?
Yeah, that's better. Jotaland. Well, we wouldn't say say the ERS at the end. We would just say, what would we say? Jotalander, I guess. It's a little bit different how we would say it. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. 8 Jotlanders and 22 Norman or Northmen on this back-taking journey from Vinland, and there is a missing word at the beginning of the third line. This back-taking journey from Vinland, extreme west, meaning West Vinland. We have to, let's see, we have two anchorages. I don't have my reading glasses on. We hove two anchorages by two skerries, one day's journey north from this stone, meaning the Kensington Runestone. We were also fishing one day. After we came home, found 10 men reddened with blood and dead. AVM, which stands for Ave Maria, a little Latin in there.
Yeah.
Salvation from evil fate, or some people use a more modern translation, modern wording of deliver us from evil, but we prefer this one. Troop of 10 men have a large winter house to look after our ship 14 days journey from beyond this island, year 1362. One thing, and that's the inscription, but one thing that's very interesting about this is that it talks of the 10 men having a large winter house to look after our ship's journey 14 days journey, or look after our ship 14 days journey from beyond this island.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe, because of that wording, from beyond this island, 14 days journey, the stone had to have been set up so that as you read it, you would be facing north, which is the direction of Hudson Bay. So 14 days. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yep, I sure do.
Yeah, so the inscription would have been set up facing south so that you would be looking to the north and see the island that's just down the hill that it refers to, that the inscription refers to. So it's 14 days journey from beyond this island.
Yeah. Now that was an important point that people missed before because they didn't get the beyond part of it. That was we got that, actually, for, at least I did, first from the Spirit Pond Runestone, where the Om is beyond, or something like it anyway, a preposition like it. They only show the M. And from in the Kensington Stone is from...
as an F-R-A or an F-R-A.
Yeah, and it's got this...
It's another abbreviation of F-R-A plus U-M, and there's a slash, a line drawn across from the A to the M to indicate that the U is missing.
Mm-hmm.
And that had not been recognized before.
Hmm. Sure. Wow. Interesting little variations. Is the, how should I put this, is the style that's on the Kensington runestone very similar to the style that's on the Spirit Pond inscription runestone?
Two completely different people did each stone.
Ah, okay.
And they do, well, the abbreviation is different, the language is different, the type of stone is different, the inscription on the Spirit Pond stone was much more wording in a much smaller space. The stone is only 11 inches or so across. Whatever that would be in centimeters. I'm not on my metric, but
me neither.
It is, it's a whole different type of writing surface, other than that they're, you know, of course they're both stone, but they're two very different types of stone, and they would react very differently to a chisel.
Yeah.
And linguistically, they were composed by two very different people also. They're both laid out very differently.
Hmm. Fascinating. There's more, of course, to this as well. More finds. The island overall, as you detailed earlier, Robert, is not to be found there today, as there's, you know, different topography. This has changed throughout the hundreds of years that has passed. But
Can I come in here?
Yeah,
for a
sure.
second?
Go ahead.
One very interesting thing about the reference to the island. When the stone was found, all people saw was a marshy lowland and a knoll. And it was just a little bit higher spot in this marshy lowland at the bottom of the runestone hill. Well, when my dad and I were there in 2001, the Department of Natural Resources, just a few years before, about three, 4 years before, had reflooded that lowland area as part of a wetland restoration project, and in cooperation with the farmers that owned some of the land in that low area. And so only a few years earlier, it was still just farmland or grazing land. And when we were looking at the site very critically in 2001, it was the old lake area restored. And when it was restored, that small knoll was now the island in the middle of this shallow lake.
So you guys, you have that photo, of course, in the book as well. That you're seeing
yep.
the island right there.
Yep, and we were, some of it was just the luck of being there at the right time. When the very, very first settlers came into the area in about the 1860s, if I've got my history correct, that low area was seen as, quite a large area of land that by just digging a trench to drain it to the next lake to the north, it would allow the farmers to have much better land to utilize
yeah.
and make a living off of. And that was about, that was quite a few years before Olaf Ullmann ever came to the United States. And most of the other settlers in that area had never seen it as a lake. They always saw it as a wetland. And no one had seen it as a lake until about 1997 or 98, when the Department of Natural Resources restored that wetland. So that was one of the issues when the Kensington runestone, after it had been found, some of the early experts reading the inscription said, well, there's no island here. How could this hill have been an island, assuming that the hill that the stone had been found on was the island referred to?
Mm.
That was not the case. If you go to the Runestone Park, stand on the top of that hill, and walk around the perimeter of that hill, and look around you, you just look at the elevations, and you can see it would have been really impossible for that hill to have ever been a fully surrounded by water island. It just doesn't make sense. And it is almost at the Laurentian Divide, that part of Minnesota. And the Laurentian Divide is the high point between drainage to the north, to Hudson Bay, and drainage that goes to the south into the Gulf of Mexico. So it just did not make sense with theories people had in the past that there must have been just large amounts of water and hill into an island. Just makes no sense if you go to the site and walk around.
Well, we verified that with the USGS contour maps too.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you look at the area there, what do you guys think? Is there potentially more finds in this area that could be made? I mean, Do you think that they chose this spot for reasons that they had settlements maybe in the area close by as well, or did they just randomly put this up as a road sign pretty much?
There may have been settlements there prior to when the Paul Knutson group came through. But I think the reason it was left where it was left is that it was probably a route where trade people went through. Not very far from there nowadays. There's a highway that it's highway number 55 that goes through Kensington, Minnesota, just a couple miles away from the site. And the highway 55 was put on an earlier route of ox cart trains, where the early white tradesmen, just as settlers were just starting to, European immigrant and white settlers were coming into the area, the tradesmen had these long, long cart after cart after cart with oxen pulling them. So you would all hitched together. So you only needed one person to drive the oxen. And that trade route would go from the Mississippi River to up to the Red River and two points heading north up toward Lake Winnipeg. And that trade route on the oxcart trails was laid out following an old Indian trade route and or Native American trade route. That trade route was probably pretty close to where the Kensington Runestone was left. Higher ground, fewer lakes to cross, no big rivers to cross. Much easier going. It makes a lot of sense. You have access to waterways that head north and waterways that head south at that point.
Now, waterways were really important for the early Norsemen because, as far as we know, they didn't have oxen. As a matter of fact, one of the marks of evidence, that is, for the presence of the Norsemen in all over the continent here are mooring stones. They're stones at the edges of lakes or streams with holes pounded in them with a broad-bladed chisel, and the hole was about an inch in diameter and anywhere from 3 to 8 inches deep. And on this little island that Jenny and I kind of discovered there, we found 5 of these mooring stones. Apparently, that island was a kind of a camping spot for Norsemen who were traveling on this water route from the Red River or the upper part of the Minnesota River over to the Mississippi River cross country by water. At least that's the natural thing to expect, anyway.
In the book, we refer to them pretty much as hole stones because they are a large granite boulder that has a hole in it that's been pounded out by hand. We did do some experimental archaeology a few years back, and my dad and I and my husband, we all pounded out a couple of holes with chisel and hammer and found out it is an awful lot of very tiring work.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's not something you would do just for fun.
Right.
You would need to have a good reason to put a hole in these stones, especially when they're granite.
Yeah.
It just takes a lot of work.
There are two main reasons for these hole stones. One is to moor boats, and the other is to mark property boundaries. That is a fact in Iceland, and the boundaries marked by such hole stones exist today. we show one of them in a, one of our pictures in the book, illustrations in the book.
Yeah.
So the hole stones that are not actually right on the water in western Minnesota and South Dakota and North Dakota are very likely the what is left of property boundary markers. And Janie was kind of the one who pointed out that this is a well-designed custom in Norway and Sweden and Scandinavian areas where they, every year on rogation day, why they walk the boundaries to make sure that nobody forgets where the boundaries are. And to do that, you follow the stones.
There are references to rogation day in the tradition. And in England, in the church parish records, they talk of rogation day, which is usually sometime in later April or early May. It's a date tied to Easter. So, and as you know, Easter has a wide range of dates, so
yeah.
Rogation day is the same. But Rogation Day was that the day that in England, at the same time period, the whole village is described to have walked the property boundaries of the parish. And the source that I had for this was that even the young boys had their backside dipped in the local creek right by the markers to make sure that they didn't forget where the edge of the property was, and other things like that. And this tradition goes way, way back, much earlier than 1300. Back in the early days of Icelandic settlement, the by about the third generation of settlement on Iceland, and settlement began in about, 874, I believe, about 874 was the year of the first group that ended up going and staying on Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
So by King Harald Fairhair's time, King of Norway, a few generations after these first settlers to Iceland, they were beginning to feel a little crowded, and property disputes began to arise. So they were having a difficult time settling it themselves, so they appealed to King Harald Fairhair, even though they were not specifically under his reign. They did go back, someone went back to Norway and said, "We need some help. We have property problems," and the result was that Harald Fairhair had a decree of how you marked your property, and we do have a bit referring to that in the book, very specific of lighting a fire in first thing in the morning, and you could only claim as much property as you could walk within a day. And you had walked the property lines with your neighbor that was on the other side of the property line.
Yeah.
And another point that is even more current with the 1300s is another runestone called the Kingatorsak stone, found on Upernavik Island off the west coast of Greenland, quite a ways up to the north. And in a cairn, a large rock pile, so that would be visible from a distance, on the high point of Upernavik Island, back in 1836, I believe it was,
mm-hmm.
the group of fishermen or whalers, whoever they were, decided, hey, let's see if there's something inside this cairn. They were on that island and wanted to take a look. So when they took the stones apart, took them down, dismantled it somewhat, they found a palm-sized piece of stone with a runic inscription on it, only a few lines long. And it's basically telling about how these three or four guys were there, and it tells that the most interesting thing to me about that inscription is that it says that they were there at a specific day. And some people have translated it incorrectly as laundry day. It was more than just laundry day that they were there. It was rogation day, and they specifically state that was when they were there.
Huh.
So they were marking property. They built that cairn as a property marker.
Mm.
Way, way up there. So this property marking tradition was being carried on, not just from Iceland and the east and west settlements in Greenland, but much further up the coast of Greenland. These guys were there, and they say, it's Rogation Day, and we're here.
Huh.
The map of Icelandic property lines that we also include in the book, one thing of interesting note is that the if you look carefully at that map, it shows that all the properties had access to water, whether it was a creek, a river, a lake, or the ocean. And the property lines, and because of that, they run how can I describe it? Narrower pieces starting at the water's edge, and they go lengthwise away from the water's edge, usually to a higher point.
Mm-hmm.
Property lines, for instance, might end at the top of a ridge or a bit of a peak or a rise in the land. And that makes sense, because if you have a property marker, whether it's a cairn or a marking stone with a pole or a staff put into it, you can see it from down below at the water's edge. You look for the high point. If you see that marker, you know that's the end of your property.
Right.
And some of these hole stones that we've looked at out in South Dakota, yes, there are many along waterways, but we have also seen others that are following the same pattern as that map of Iceland and its ancient farm property.
They're up on the hill.
They're up on a high, prominent point.
Yeah.
That you would see from down the valley, down at the water, or down at the edge of a lake. So
that's even more evidence, of course, suggesting
yes,
that
yes, it follows same pattern.
That's right. Is there any suggestion as to potentially how many people have been in the, I mean, it's a big area that we're talking about, first of all, and it's many, well, there's a couple of hundred years here, potentially even more that we're talking about. Any suggestion as to how many people might have been in this area that were, you know, coming either from Greenland or obviously their generations even born at that point in on the North American continent? So
well,
is there any way
no,
we can know?
No one has ever estimated this, and I'm sure that's true, because until Janie and I did our research, no one believed that there were any Norsemen on the continent.
Right, yep.
So there's a lot of archaeological work that really should be done to flesh this story out. We, in a way, we just sort of have begun it. We think we've got the whole thing pretty well corralled, but
it's the tip of the iceberg. So
that's right. There's
yeah.
more to it, and it would be really great if we could get the archaeologists and anthropologists convinced enough to change, maybe put a little of their money instead of doing the Indians, do the Norsemen. You
yeah,
know.
Yeah. How has the reception been on this work, on your work? Has it been largely just ignored or discredited, or is it well received? Is it varied? What happens?
There are two. The people who are of Scandinavian interest, like the Icelanders, you know, or the people of Norwegian descent, they're very enthusiastic. Now, we have one contact, Henrik Williams. He is the runic authority at the Uppsala University in Sweden.
Yep, I know of him.
And we heard him talk just a few, 3 weeks ago or so. And how would you characterize his reaction, Jeannie?
So what he did tell me at the talk was that he did get our book, and he's looked through it, although when I asked him some questions, I could tell he hadn't thoroughly read it at all. But
yeah,
did say, I don't agree with everything you have in there, but it's very interesting, is basically how he phrased it. I don't know, his demeanor at the time, I think he was very respectful of what we have put out there with it.
Mm-hmm.
Another indication of his feeling might be that he said he wouldn't be a bit surprised if we found another genuine runestone.
Oh, yeah?
Hmm. Or somebody.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Following on from that thought, where would you guys suggest that there would be more findings? I mean, we're talking about a huge area. There might be, you know, hundreds of different things, buried evidence.
Well,
I
have a favorite.
Yep.
A favorite example of that. The Lancel Meadows settlement has been verified up to the hilt. I mean, the archaeologists have a thorough knowledge of the Lancel Meadows site. Everybody accepts that.
Yeah.
And those ruins were actually visible to a careful eye, you know, who was looking for them. That's how they were found. Now, up at the mouth of the Nelson River, or the Hayes River, we know they built a big house to take care of 10 troops, or a troop of 10 men, plus the crew of this big ship that was going to take Knudsen back. So that big house would have decayed away into a ruin eventually, and it ought to be visible up there. If we could find someone who would go up there and do the legwork, the field work, to look for it. It ought to be as visible as the ruin was in Lancel Meadows.
Wow.
The Lancel Meadows site, the comment made before it was recognized for what it was that, oh, those old Indian ruins over there, or those old Indian mounds,
right.
What do you want with them?
Yeah.
So it would be a similar type of thing up around the mouth of the Nelson and the Hayes.
The only possible problem with that approach is that they would have probably built their house in the most favorable place, so other subsequent people might have occupied that place also and might have spoiled the purity of the archaeology, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's always difficult. You have different people moving in, and if there's a house, you know, positioned
right.
at some place, they take it over later or what have you. So, yeah, that's
right.
That's true.
Oh, and also now if you are at the shore of Hudson Bay, that shoreline is not where the shoreline would have been back in 1362.
Right, yeah.
Of isostatic rebound, meaning that the pressure on the Earth's crust of land when it had glacial ice, very, very thick, heavy glacial ice sitting on it, it pushed down the Earth and the land. And even now, today, 8,000 plus years later, the crust is still rebounding, coming back up somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
And the old lakeshore of Hudson Bay is some distance away from the current lakeshore, or current shore of Hudson Bay.
Yeah.
Not the lake, it's the sea. But,
yeah. There could be canals that was obviously much deeper at some point. They could even travel inland more with the, I don't know, bigger ships. How big were some of the ships that they came with?
We are, let's see, there is a very interesting museum in Bremen in Germany, the COG Museum, COG, and that was a type of ship that became the norm for trade on the Baltic and up around Norway and over to England and other points by the mid-1300s. It was a much deeper hulled ship, single mast still, with a rear rudder and a fore and an aft castle on them, mainly for putting archers on in defense, because pirates were a real problem back then.
Yeah.
But that's the type of ship that the Hansa trade union people used, because they could carry, you know, being a deeper hulled ship, they could carry more goods.
Big loads, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, per expedition, per voyage. Yeah. So the we believe that the ship that would have been crossing the Atlantic with King Haakon and his crew and retinue and all the other people, that it would have been a larger ship than the what you would think of as a classic Viking ship of a few hundred years earlier, especially since they seem to have been planning on staying for a few years. If you're going to be building a fortified church with a tower, you're going to need quite a few tools for it. You'll need some cattle, some sheep. You've got to be able to feed and clothe your workers and your troops, and a lot of people to take care of. So it was quite a bit of
good. Probably bigger than some of those Columbus had, actually.
Oh, really?
Well, he was on a very thin budget, we are told, anyway. The smallest of his three ships was not a big ship at all.
Interesting. Is this part of history actively being suppressed in your view, Robert or Jenny?
I don't know. The last time that I checked the official website for the COG Museum in Bremen, this was a few years back now, they had an appeal on their website that if you, you general public viewing our website, if you come across any images of COG ships, please let us know. So that they were trying to collect as many images as a collection or a reference of COG ships of the later medieval time period. So it's something that's it's not unknown. It's just not recognized an awful lot. I suppose if you're very well versed in history of shipbuilding, people like that should know quite a bit about COG ships. We're not super experts on it, but the evidence of what was used for trade at that time was that they were deeper hulled COG type ships.
Right. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, in North America, it isn't really a matter of suppression of history, but it is a problem in refusing to look at the evidence that we have. And there are some very prominent people whose name I won't name who have done that and apparently are still doing it, at least the last time I saw them on television. They were they refused to take into account any evidence supporting the idea that there were large numbers of Norsemen or any Norsemen at all after the Vinland voyages of Leif Erikson and Carl Stepney.
Yeah.
And this is really kind of sad because there's a real story here backed by historical evidence, historical documentation, and stuff you find in the field, like the hole stones and other carvings that the Norse have made. And if you don't look at it,
you won't see it.
Have to change your mind at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you guys you have photographs of these other markings as well, not only the hole stones, but kind of a image of a drinking horn as well, right? This is in the same area.
Yep.
That's right.
That one. When our host Judy Rudebush showed that to us, she didn't tell us she was going to show us anything other than hole stones. He surprised us with that one. And when I first saw it, it was like, oh my goodness, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
And looking at it a couple other times when we were out in that area, more critically examining it with a magnifying glass, because it's out in the field, I could see that the first question is this man-made or is it a natural feature? And it didn't take much examination on my part at all to see, no, this is not a natural feature at all. I can still see where if you're looking at the hornstone photo, there are two top corners of the carving, indicating the top edges of the horn, where the opening of the horn is.
Yeah.
And I can see where a chisel, the only thing that could have made those corners shaped the way they are, is a chisel. And I can see where a chisel struck it. And it is so deep and a very specific shape and about the size of an actual horn. You would not be able to carve something like that without the chisel. And where the chisel struck it, where it hadn't worn out, weathered away greatly, is there. And that hornstone has been there ever since the very first white settlers came. And it looked very, very old at that time. This was Judy's grandparents or great-grandparents?
Grandparents.
Yeah. They were the first settlers on that land. And it was there long before they got there.
Yeah.
So... another interesting thing that we did was put a straight yardstick or ruler across that opening, the gap in the stone where the horn image is. And when you do that, you get an even greater understanding of how long that stone has weathered, because the edges of the horn have greatly eroded away. And in a granite stone like that, that takes a long time to have that much of the stone degrade and weather away.
What do you estimate, if you could speculate, how many years are we looking at?
Oh, hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there is in the book this picture of the knife stone, they call it. When you very carefully examine the carved image and fill in some of the places where weathering has affected the edges, particularly of the handle. You get a good idea of the shape. It's not a weapon knife, it's a kitchen knife, but it has a crook in the handle, like you would have for a kitchen knife. It has a very sharp point, and in a book called
Discovering Horn.
Yeah, Discovering Horn, which is all about how what animal horn was used for back in medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
It has a picture of a very similar knife with a sharp point on the tip, and it says this type of knife was used like we use forks today. It was used to both cut the meat and to stab the pieces and put the piece in your mouth.
And would have had a horn handle. That's why
it had a horn handle, yeah.
Yeah.
So that type of knife went out of style when forks came into use in Europe in about 1600. So that particular piece of evidence says that that carving was done before 1600, probably long before, actually, probably back in the maybe 1200 or something like that.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, there's so much in the book that details the specifics of this. And, well, again, I wanted to ask you guys before we begin to wrap things up for this time, if there should be, I guess, where you would like to see work done next, or if both of you have some ideas of what you want to look into next, or continue this you know, path of discovery, pretty much, as there is more to look into.
Oh, goodness. well, one thing that I would like bring up briefly is an archaeologist named Pat Sutherland, and she's Canadian. She was featured in National Geographic magazine last October, I believe it was, 2012. Not a very long article, but touching on the fact that she, for more than 10 years, had been doing excavations in the high Arctic on the south end of Baffin Island, as well as other sites. And she has been finding, with other people working with her, of course, finding in archaeological dig sites that previously had been considered native Dorset or Thule, predecessor to the current Inuit people. Mm-hmm. Up in that dwelling sites. And the artifacts that she and crew were coming across indicated otherwise.
Are you talking about the iron?
No.
A good story.
Well, that's a different. That's a whole nother program. But one artifact specifically is a carved wooden figure of a man with a long kind of coat type of outfit on with a slit up the middle, so appropriate for riding a horse. But on his chest is a cross as part of the carving. And it's typical of something that a knight of the time of the 1300s, 1200s, 1100s may have worn with the slit for his coat to allow him to straddle a horse.
Hmm.
Now, what this would have been doing in a native site is a big question mark. And that's one of a number of items. Unfortunately, right after that article came out, or at the time that article came out, for some reason, Pat Sutherland was not allowed to access artifacts from many of these dig sites from the museum in Ottawa that she was affiliated with. Now, what's actually going on is a big question mark. She cannot say. I heard a Canadian broadcasting interview with her, and she cannot say because it is in court at this time, and mm-hmm. she cannot say what is going on.
All right.
It seems gut instinct wise to be something rather political.
Right.
To me, mm-hmm. anyway.
Yeah.
That she's finding things that are turning some archaeologists completely upside down in what they have been saying has been the past cultural history of Canada.
Yeah.
And politically a very difficult thing.
So maybe they prefer to just, for now anyway, kind of just brush that under the rug and try to get rid
yes.
of the evidence. Yeah.
Yes. So,
yeah.
Another site that I would personally like to see examined more closely is Codelinarn Island in Frobisher Bay, which is a long bay at the south end of Baffin Island. That site is given. Well, Frobisher Bay is called Frobisher Bay because of the English explorer, Frobisher, who was there in the 1570s. He made three expeditions. Initially, he went with a crew and a few ships to look for the Northwest Passage, that elusive quick trade route to head to the Far East, which he never found. But he ended up on this particular island. A very small island, not much bigger than a few football fields. He had members of the party dig some pits to look for gold. And they dug up ore. They brought back, 80,000 pounds worth of ore in their ships.
Really?
I think it's red. It was a massive amount, it seemed to me.
Hmm.
They certainly didn't need any ballast stones. And headed back to England, showed this ore to investors, telling them, oh, look, this has gold in it. It was probably fool's gold, which is gold-looking and kind of sparkly, and it convinces fools that it's authentic when it wasn't. That's my guess. But they were convinced to fund another expedition back to Codelinarn Island. Well, he made a second expedition, went back to England, and made a third, and then they never heard from him again. So he probably got frozen in. Who knows? Ships went down in the storm. Could have been many, many different things. But at the site on Codelinarn Island, back in the 1860s, I believe it was, someone going to the site looking for evidence of what happened to Frobisher found some what are called iron blooms. And iron blooms are just raw smelted iron that hasn't been shaped into any usable tool. It's iron to go, to take with you
yep.
and have your blacksmith make it into whatever tool you need on site, kind of a thing.
Yep.
And tests, at the time, because it was found at the site where they did know Frobisher had been, it was assumed that they were from the 1500s, Frobisher's time period.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago or so, the more refined method of carbon 14 dating became useful, or someone perfected it, so that if you had iron that was an iron object that had not had lime added to it to take out the impurities, which would kind of corrupt your findings for you. You could date using carbon-14 dating. You could date the iron using what was left of the carbon in it.
Right.
And the results that came back from these five different bloom samples from the Frobisher site put the dating of them not in the 1500s, but back in the 1300s and very early 1400s. And keep in mind, carbon-14 dating usually plus or minus a certain number of years. So these are plus or minus 30 years or 40 years or whatever. So all of these samples could have, well, they certainly were not from the 1500s. And the plus or minus dating of them put them all very possibly, most likely, in the mid-1300s. And when these test results came out, in the chart where I read the results, it was put in, these results are put into the category of they do not match what was thought to be the date, but we don't know why. Basically, we can't explain this category.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the archaeologists that had been examining Frobisher's site previously to that said, Frobisher must have brought those iron blooms all the way from England, and they must have been really old ones from England that were a few hundred years old.
Hmm.
Now, to me, that sounds rather silly.
Stupid.
Yeah.
Because why would you be bringing older iron when by the 1500s, mid-1500s, they probably had much better smelting technique?
Right.
Why would you be bringing old stuff like this?
Yeah.
To me, it says Frobisher went to this tiny little island thinking there was something there, because he saw that someone had been there previously to him. And those iron blooms were left by the north of the 1300s.
We know, for example, that at Lanza Meadows, that settlement, the Norse made iron rivets out of the bog iron that they found nearby. So we know they knew how to smelt iron.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they made bog iron on Greenland, too. They knew how to extract it.
This is, as well as I'm looking into this, as you're talking about this, this is close to Baffin Island as well. And this is spoken about in Hellulunda, in one of the sagas of the Greenlanders.
Yep.
So it's this area, if you will, is mentioned in there, but it's still, I guess, these are considered to be sagas, so they're kind of more, it's more mythology, so it's probably not true. That seems to be the attitude, if you will, of most people looking into this, yet there are being evidence here.
I still think it was just big stories.
I don't think so. Not at all. Of course not. This is how they wrote it at the time. These are the documented facts as they began to write down their history, you know? So
Yeah.
Wow.
One other interesting thing about this Frobisher site of Coldlanarn Island is that there is a what's left of a half height stone foundation of a quite small dwelling. It was, I don't remember the specific measurements, but maybe 10 by 15 feet. So what would that be in meters? Or
3 by 5, yeah.
Yeah. Not built on top of the ground, dug down into the ground partially.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, using the soil as part of your dwelling structure, do you catch what I'm
sure.
saying?
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Partially down in the ground, you're more protected from wind.
The elements,
and
yeah.
You have less wall to have to build. And
this is how some of the longhouses were built. They were built down into the ground for that reason. It's easier when the snow yep. comes and everything, yeah.
On Iceland, it's attributed to, that's where Frobisher had his place where he stayed. The men all lived in tents. They do know that they did bring tents with them. That's what the workers they lived in. But they're saying, this stone-walled, what remains of it, was where Frobisher stayed. Well, maybe he did, but I don't think he built that. Not the foundation part. I think he utilized what was already there, because
yeah. But what would he have used?
What would he have used?
Yeah, he'd had to have a lot of driftwood and stuff. And my guess is he had a tent too.
Maybe he put a tent on top of it. But my point is that dwelling places on Iceland around 1,000 and 1,100 when a new settler would come to Iceland, they needed a quick dwelling. And this is written about, documented in Nancy Marie Brown's book about Goodrich, titled The Far Traveler. She's been to these sites on Iceland and helped even in an archaeological dig site. And the farmers, the wealthy farmers, would bring slaves. They had slaves, or heavily indentured, basically slaves, laboring people with them. And the first dwelling they would do was half into the ground, dwelling with some stone and then timbers and sod roof above, sod walls the rest of the way, and then some timbers and the sod roof. It was the quickest, pretty weather-tight type of dwelling to build. And usually they were about the size as described as this one on Kolbeinarn Island. On Iceland, the earlier ones were round, because that's even quicker than doing something that is squared, cornered.
Mm-hmm.
Later ones by the 12 and 1300s were square cornered. And the description that Nancy Marie Brown gives in her book is just what I read on the Canadian Park Service website about this dwelling on Kolbeinarn Island. I think it was initially built by Norse who were there, maybe as a base for whaling, for getting walrus ivory. They had many reasons to be up that high in the Arctic. The walrus ivory was very, very valuable.
And maybe at a time when not that it was easy, but maybe it wasn't as severe in terms of the weather at that point.
The climate was milder then.
Much milder,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes, it was.
And we know there's a big article on that by a professor by the name of Schlederman. He describes the activity of the Norse even farther north than southern Baffin Island, all the way up at beyond the north end of Baffin Island in the Nares Strait.
Wow.
That's
far up there.
About 78 degrees latitude or 79 degrees latitude, as I recall.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
I would like to see a fresh eye taking a look at the Frobisher Kolbeinarn Island site.
Very good. Well, excellent, guys. This has been tremendously fascinating. There's tons of material, I think, to be discovered about this neglected part of history and the relationship between North America and Scandinavia, these early travelers and how they interacted with the locals at that time, and obviously the consequent history the persecution as well. There's just so much more to it. We encourage, of course, our audience that want to know more about this at the moment to pick up a copy of the book that we've been talking about to find out more for yourself. It's called The Last Kings of Norse America. And the website is thelastkingsofnorseamerica.com. We'll have that linked up. This has been great, guys. I want to thank you both for your time, for sharing it with us. And I hope we can touch base at some point again. Let's say thank you to you, Robert, first. We really appreciate having you on. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be on.
Excellent. And to you as well, Janie. Thank you so much for your time. This has been great. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. I appreciate your interest and for your ability to let people speak their mind. No matter if we agree or disagree, we trust in your ability to decide for yourself. And as a sovereign, free individual, we believe that you should have access to as much information as possible to be able to reason accordingly. My thanks to Frederick, Lana, and Elizabeth. And I wish you have a great rest of your day or evening. We will talk more soon. Bye-bye.